businesses can crash and burn in a good economy and in a bad economy because you can't scale up fast enough or you can't scale down fast enough. So you have to design systems that allow you to scale as your customers come and go if you're going to be a sustainable business.
You're listening to Real Marketing Real Fast, the only podcast that brings you unfiltered, undaunted, insider information on the latest tools and technologies for online marketers. Prepare to dive deep into marketing myths, breakthrough models, and cutting-edge strategies that will have an immediate impact on the growth of your business. And now, here's your host, marketing expert Doug Morneau.
Well, welcome back, listeners, to another episode of Real Marketing Real Fast. Today, I'm going to start my introduction just a little bit different. So I want to read you a couple testimonials of our guest. It's been a pleasure to work with Mark each time we've had him involved in a joint project. He's one of the most creative and innovative people I know, always achieving great results on time and within the agreed budget. He's one of the nicest guys I've ever met. I can't recommend Mark's work highly enough, and I would use him and his company again in a heartbeat. And that is a recommendation from the regional manager of Dell. So I had a chance to talk to Mark before we interviewed and connected with him on social media, and he is a really sharp guy. There's a ton of information we're going to share with you, but just a heads up, I'll give you a little bit of advance notice of one of the secrets that he's going to share, and that is the 7 P's of risk reduction. So what are the 7 things that you can do to help your potential customer or purchaser of your product or service reduce the risks of doing business with you, move you ahead of your competitors, and make it easy for them to say yes? So with that said, I don't want to take any more of Mark's time. I'd like to welcome Mark Smith to the Real Marketing Real Fast podcast today. Well, Mark, I'm super excited to have you on the Real Marketing Real Fast podcast today. I just want to say thanks so much for taking time out of your schedule to talk to me and to talk to our audience.
Doug, I'm delighted to talk with you. I'll do it anytime that you want.
Well, it's always fun, you know, to be in social media space and see who's really social. And I mean, that's how you and I connected.
That's right.
And I often say that it doesn't work because people are using it for broadcast, but this isn't the case between you and I.
Right. You reached out to me and I said, hell yeah.
So why don't you share with our audience before we get a deep dive in the topic, you know, what your superpower is?
Gladly. My superpower is helping entrepreneurs become executives. I help them shift from entrepreneurial mindset, and that is where you do everything. You can do everything. You do everything, which creates a limit on your business, to an executive where you do absolutely nothing. There's more on an executive's to-think list than on their to-do list. That's a huge shift. So I help people make that transition so they have the mindset, the skill set, and the tool set to run a business versus be the business. And I do that primarily through my Executive Strategy Summit, a 2-day event that I hold throughout the United States multiple times a year. And we'll talk more about that later.
Well, that's really cool. And I mean, and you're so right. I mean, I remember starting my business where I did everything. And now I look at, I've got team and I have thinking days. I have thinking weekends where my wife and I'll just go away and shut everything off. And I find, you know, that's a really good way to get clarity and to spend some serious time planning opposed to being in the office just doing every day.
Right on. Doug, you know, the most important thing to remember is an executive creates a future that does not yet exist, using methods that have not yet been invented, where best practices have yet to be established.
Yep.
And that requires a lot of thought time. And you can't create that new future if you're stuck in today. So making that transition from doing everything to creating is a huge shift for a lot of people, but it's the difference between making a couple million a year and making hundreds of millions a year.
So how do you help people make that leap? Because I find that most people are very uncomfortable with change. They want to stay with the status quo, even if it's not working. They just want to work at it harder or run faster, but they're still going the wrong direction. So clearly, you know, if you're not getting the results, something needs to change. So how do you help people change their mindset to do that?
Well, the first thing you have to do is realize that you have a blind spot. And are you familiar with Martech's law?
I am not. Nope.
It's a fantastic concept, and it was created by Scott Brinker, who is the VP of Platforms for HubSpot. And he was on my show. You might want to interview him for your show sometimes. He's an excellent conversationalist. And what he identified is that technology grows exponentially, while our ability to adapt to change is logarithmic.
Okay.
So while technology fundamentally doubles every 12 to 18 months in capacity, our ability to change is about 10% year over year. And what happens is the gap between what people are using and the technology available widens to the point there's a forced reset. And we are on that really steep curve of technology where even the technologists are having a hard time hanging on and keeping up.
Yeah.
And so what we have to first of all realize is there's a massive gap between what's possible and what we're doing. And once you understand you have that gap and you've got that mindset of saying, I'm going to close that gap as quickly as I can, then you can become a candidate to make the pivot into the strategic thinking. Unfortunately, most people believe they're strategic thinkers and they're not. And let me tell you what is the clue. If you're talking to somebody who says they're thinking strategy and you know they're not, it's if you present an idea that doesn't yet exist and they respond with, yeah, but. When you hear that, they're stuck in tactics.
Yeah.
And the reason why is when I'm working with truly strategic thinkers, they say yes and. They never say yes but, because they know they're forging a path that doesn't yet exist. Versus people who are stuck in the tactics, they go, yeah, but we've never done it that way. Yeah, but we tried that and it doesn't work anymore. Yeah, but I don't know how we're going to get that done. Well, that's all stuck in strategy. That is not executive thinking.
Sure, that totally makes sense. I mean, I just recorded my 100th episode. And
congratulations. Woohoo!
Thank you. I heard that once you make it past 7, you're actually in the podcast business.
I'm at 86, so you're just a few episodes ahead of me, friend.
Well, it's been a journey, and what I shared was a bit of encouragement with people. I said, you know, you've got all these goals and things you want to do, and I had no idea how to run and start a podcast. So, you know, I hired a different consultant. I joined, you know, some online forums and joined the guys at Podcasters Paradise, and I learned from them about half of what I actually needed, and then I went forward. I didn't know how to write a book, but I made a commitment to my publisher to write 3 books, and, you know, at the end of the year, I'd written 2 books, published one. So my, you know, not even thinking of outside strategy, just looking at common stuff that people see every day, I said, just take the leap, just get started. You don't need to know all the answers on how to get there. They'll come to you. People will come to you. The pieces will come to you. And yeah, forget about that. Well, I don't know how I'm going to write a book, or I don't know how I'm going to start a podcast.
Right on.
Yeah.
Right on. And yeah, let me give you a quick little clue here. Executives don't know all the answers, but they do know how to ask the right questions.
Yeah. Yeah. And find people that are smarter than you that can fill in the gaps.
Right. You find the smarter tacticians.
Yeah.
You know, just because you don't know how. Well, the problem too, Doug, is that we've all been programmed and we've been rewarded with knowing how to do things.
Yeah.
We've went through 12 years of grade school and high school and however many years of college. And all of our grades were based on your ability to know how to respond to a question versus knowing what question to create. And really the only folks that know how to create questions are philosophers.
Yeah, and I'm not going to do well in that arena.
Indeed, but we just have to make that transition from realizing that you're not judged as an executive leader by your how power. You're judged by your ability to round up a team that figures out how.
So if I'm an entrepreneur listening to this and, you know, I'm wearing the marketing hat and the sales hat and the product delivery hat, what are some steps we can take or some ways that we can start to change our thinking to move in this direction from entrepreneur to executive?
Well, first of all, understand that the prime directive of every executive is you hold the vision for the company, and it's not a democracy. Nobody else in the company gets to vote on what your vision of the company is going to be. There's only one visionary leader. And then as part of that holding the vision, you also have to create the culture of the organization. A CEO's domain is vision and culture. And then their job is to make sure the rest of the team executes to that vision and maintains that culture. Then the other players within the organization that you have to switch hats around when you're an entrepreneur until you can bring on the team are responsible for different domains. For example, the CFO is responsible for the money domain, and the CIO is responsible for the data domain, and the CHRO is responsible for the team domain, and the CRO, Chief Revenue Officer, is responsible for the customer domain, and the COO is responsible for everything else, all the physical assets, as well as customer satisfaction. And once you understand that there's these various domains that large companies through hundreds of years have developed these silos that make sense because of the brain set, the mindset required to operate each of those functions and to look after, to curate each of those domains. So part of making that transition from an entrepreneur to executive is understand that you can't wear multiple hats unless you know what the hat is supposed to be. And there literally is a radically different mindset for each one of those C-suite players.
Sure there is.
And
yeah, I've had conversations with the CFOs of my clients' companies as we're negotiating more cash for the sales and marketing.
Right. And of course, once you understand the key performance indicators for each of those players, then you can do the right thing to make sure that you're operational. Let me pop up a layer here. The challenge with most entrepreneurs is they're good at one or two of the seven areas of business that you must master to run a successful business, a business that's sustainable, scalable, profitable, and ultimately saleable.
Yep.
And by the way, those are important in that order. If your business isn't sustainable, I don't care how profitable you are, it's going to crash and burn. It has to be scalable. Otherwise, you're not going to grow with the market up and down. You know, profitability is absolutely something we're aiming for. And then saleability is important. Most entrepreneurs create a business that is unsaleable because they are the product. So creating the business strategy so that you can actually sell your assets in the future without necessarily selling yourself a J-O-B, which is what a lot of entrepreneurs end up doing, which is just not a good thing.
No.
So we have to understand there's fundamentally seven areas that we have to master to run a business. The first one is we have to have products that create unique value for our target market. And every one of those words is important. So product development, product design, whether it's a service or anything else, you have to understand how that works. Most entrepreneurs are really good at that because entrepreneurs are really good at organizing chaos.
Some are. Yeah, well, I struggle with that sometimes.
Well, that's what we do, though. You organize the chaos of helping people find customers.
Yep.
And so that is chaotic for a lot of people. That's an interesting thing. You have to also have a specific strategy for creating a product that also tracks the marketplace. That's another conversation that you have to have, is how do you keep that product mix the right mix? Because part of our job as an executive is to direct the company, to lead the company, to guide the company to where the customer money will be in the future.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. I'm going to send you a note on a book I wrote called Hunger in Paradise. And he talks about very large companies like SAP and Lego and Netflix and Blockbusters and the challenges they've had in the marketplace and how they all almost lost it because of that.
Right. And we can't fall in love with our products. We have to fall in love with our customers.
Yep. Wow. That's the first time I've ever heard somebody say that, because everyone loves their product and wants to tell all the benefits of the product, and the customer is just, and you know, means to the end.
Well, and let's make sure we put a pinpoint in that, because I want to get back to that particular point. I want to finish up this particular topic. Then let's go back to that point about the difference between falling in love with your customers and falling in love with your product, because I've got some really good stuff for you around there that can help you make that pivot.
Sure.
All right. So the second thing we have to have, second pillar of business is marketing. Of course, you know that we have to find customers, and the marketing has to trigger a relevant conversation. And every one of those words is critical. We want to make sure that what our marketing does is alerts people who can use us, who can find us valuable, to reach out and contact us to initiate a conversation. That conversation ideally is in person for complex, expensive products. It could be something where they just go and read and have an interaction with your website and purchase from you, but it has to trigger that.
Sure. Yeah.
And just a quick review here. There's fundamentally three forms of marketing. There's search, outreach, and word of mouth. So search is having the right website so that people can find you when they ask Google or Alexa or Siri what they're looking for. And the second one is outreach. That's where we target who we want to work with. And for most entrepreneurial organizations, that's the best methodology. And advertising is an outreach methodology.
Right.
Because we want to put it in front of the people that we believe are going to want to do business with us. And the third one is word of mouth. And a lot of businesses are word of mouth style of businesses. The challenge with that is that we don't control the words coming out of our customers' mouths.
Yeah.
And it's not scalable.
Yes.
And if you have a word of mouth based marketing business, you are unsaleable. Nobody is going to buy your business if it's based on word of mouth. Sorry. So the way I look at word of mouth is this is a icing on the cake. It's the candles on the cake. And what we have to do is go back and create a good search and an outreach methodology for our marketing. So notice that search, outreach, and word of mouth spell sow, S-O-W. And the way to remember that is that we reap in sales what we sow in marketing. So that takes us to the third point, which is sales that facilitates a mutually profitable transaction. Both sides have to get paid, and sales is the facilitator of that. And part of sales' job is to reduce perceived risk. And there's a place I want to go eventually, is how do we reduce that perceived risk? Because the difference between somebody buying from you and not is how they perceive it as being risky to do business with you, based on my conversations and research.
Yep. No one wants to make a mistake.
Never. Nobody. Yep. Nobody. Nope. Not one. All right. Then the fourth pillar of business is customer service that earns loyalty. And loyalty doesn't come from a transaction. It comes from taking care of customers post-transaction. And if you take a look at all the reviews that people give post-transaction, there are no three-star reviews in the wild, because that's, I got what I needed. We exchanged fair trade. There's nothing to talk about. No, the really juicy stuff is four-star and five-star reviews. And of course, a five-star review typically increases profitability by 7 to 10%, depending on the organization. It's a leading indicator of larger sales in the future, a trailing indicator of customer satisfaction. But the thing that's quite interesting is that five-star reviews are always above and beyond. They're never just what you expected. So that customer service is what creates the loyalty, earns the loyalty. And the way that you can test that, of course, is with five-star reviews.
Yeah, that's so true. I'm thinking when I leave reviews for people that ask, or even if I'm on Yelp and I'm out someplace, I mean, they really have to do something exceptional to get a five-star review. If I show up at a restaurant and you feed me a meal that shows up on time and is hot, that's not a five-star review. That's the minimum, level of acceptable service.
Right on. That's just that's get you 3 stars, and that gets you nothing as far as loyalty.
Yep.
And so it's really important that we build a customer service that builds that loyalty and generates 5-star reviews. And here's another podcast we have another time, is how do you engineer a 5-star review? Well, it ends up there's a process that you can go through to engineer a customer experience to create a 5-star review. And that's really cool. So that's the fourth business acumen that you must have. Then the fifth one is an infrastructure that scales with business cycles. Businesses can crash and burn in a good economy and in a bad economy because you can't scale up fast enough or you can't scale down fast enough. So you have to design systems that allow you to scale as your customers come and go if you're going to be a sustainable business. Then the sixth pillar is finance that controls cash flow and funds the future. Now, cash is king.
Yep.
And most entrepreneurial businesses crash and burn because they run out of cash.
Sure.
So you have to have the systems in place to do that. And if you're swapping hats, you probably aren't going to do a good job with that. You need to have somebody that helps you look after that. An entrepreneur usually makes a lousy CFO.
Yeah, I'm laughing because I'm in that category.
It's I resemble that remark.
Let's spend more on marketing.
Yeah. Well, that's why you need to outsource your CFO function, to a CPA who knows what they're doing. Yep. A bookkeeper's not a CFO. A bookkeeper just keeps the books. But so the other aspect of that is creating a fund the future strategy. Now, you work with a lot of VCs, and you know that if you have a VC that comes in and funds your company, your business model changes.
Sure does.
And so the source of funds always dictates your business model. And if you can control the source of funds where you are the one who decides where the money goes, you're going to be able to maintain your business model. And if you don't control the source of funds, your business model is going to shift depending on who comes in with their money. And that's an important consideration that a lot of entrepreneurs don't think about as they're making the pivot to an executive. Then the seventh pillar is a culture that creates a valuable brand. As you know, Doug, culture is the baseline of branding. Because as Peter Trucker pointed out, culture eats strategy for breakfast. And we've already talked about culture a little earlier, about that the CEO, the lead of the organization, has to set that culture.
Sure.
So entrepreneurs have to be able to master those seven elements or know enough about them to be able to ask questions of the people that they bring in to run those various elements of the business.
And that's a really good point. So listeners, don't be scared off. I know that's a pretty extensive list, but like Mark said, if you don't have these skills, you need to be able to ask the right questions for the people that are going to be part of your team.
Indeed. And when I work with my executives in a coaching capacity, frequently the problems that we have to undo, the knots we have to untie, are based on the fact that they brought in somebody who claimed they could take care of sales or marketing or operations or finance. And they abdicated responsibility to those people without knowing how to control it or ask the right questions or look at the key performance indicators, and then they get seriously burnt.
Yeah, that's a huge point that you could have a whole separate discussion on. You're right. I mean, I've been on both sides of that. And, you know, I also say that as your company scales and grows, one of the other considerations is just because these are the people that you started with in your team, they might not be able to keep up. You might need to replace them.
Right on. And you have to be able to bring people in and let people go based on the function for the business.
Yeah.
And here's a little insight that might be helpful for the listener. And that is, you have to hire people you don't like to do jobs you don't like to do.
That's funny.
Because quite frankly, if you like to do it, they'd be like you.
Yep.
And that's because the mindset, the temperament, the way that they look at the world view, it's the way they communicate. All those things are very different. And in the work that I do with my clients, we dig deeply into how people process information so that you can communicate with them at the right level and understand why you don't like them.
Yeah,
and how to respect them instead.
And they have different personality styles.
Right on.
Right? I mean, I'm not an analytical, like I have analytics for my marketing, but I don't lean that way.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, can I have a great conversation with an analytical person? Yeah, it gets a bit boring for me and they're a bit slow, but that's a conversation we need to have.
Indeed. And so you have to work with them in a way that they get it, because as the leader of the company, you're responsible for the communication.
Sure.
You are. If they don't get it, it's your problem, not theirs. As the leader of the company,
yeah,
if they don't get it, it's your problem.
I think that's often overlooked. And, you know, I obviously can't speak for our listeners, but I just think of the times when, you know, I have team locally and I have team remote. And I think the biggest learning curve I had was when I started adding remote staff.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that really helped my communication skills, because we're not sitting in the same boardroom across the table with a whiteboard. Now we're sitting in different continents and different time zones and often different cultures having a conversation.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. With different feedback mechanisms that we have to learn how to use. Right on.
So that's a lot in a really short period of time. So
welcome to my fire hose, Doug.
Yeah, let's take one of these and let's do a deeper dive. So at the end of the day, we can feel good and go to sleep tonight knowing that we accomplished at least one of them.
Well, here's the good news. Listeners, you can always rewind. And Doug, like most great podcasters, has show notes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we transcribed the entire podcast because it's good for readers. I had one of the guys that trains with me at the gym. He goes, "Yeah, I don't listen to stuff online. I read your podcast." I went, "Are you serious?"
Mm-hmm.
He went, "Why?" I said, "It's like 8,000 words. Who reads that?" He goes, "I don't like listening to podcasts." Like, oh, wow, you're the first person I knew who's after you read all the show notes. So welcome to my audience.
That's great. I love it. I do the same thing. Yeah, podcast transcriptions allow people to go back and pick out the important things, especially for information-dense podcasts. So,
yeah. So where should we start? Do you want to talk about...
Let's talk about sales.
Sales, okay.
Yeah, and the reason why is that, I hypothesize that our listeners are going to agree with you. The number one thing that entrepreneurs and executives ask me to help them with is deal flow.
Okay.
Help us get more deals.
Yep. and the right, or actually, I would say help me get profitable deals with companies and spaces that I like to work in.
There it is. That's getting even better granularity. That's more accurate. Well, the interesting thing about sales is that the fundamental sales methodology that we use today was invented back in the late 1800s by John Patterson, who headed up National Cash Register.
That's funny.
Which was the original IT,
yep.
The original information technology.
Sure.
And he was selling a cash register to a shopkeeper whose way of keeping track of the money in the cigar box was a scrap of butcher paper and a pencil.
Right.
And he came in and said, "Look, you don't have to sit there and tend that cigar box. We actually have this machine that allows you to have an assistant manage the transaction so that you can actually sell to your clients." And the way this works is that every time there's a transaction, it rings a bell so you can look over and look at the flags that just popped up and audit the transaction to make sure that they're putting the right amount of money into the till. And that allows you to step away from the front desk and to run a more profitable business. Well, that's a compelling value proposition. You know, we still even say, "Let me ring in your purchase today."
Sure. Yeah. Funny. Yeah.
And so he had a methodology that he created. It was a 16-page book called The Book of Sales Arguments that essentially was a pitch. Here's why you need to buy the cash register. Here are the value propositions. And it became so effective, it was the holy grail of selling. And in the 1930s, one out of six executives had been through the NCR sales school. And it still perpetuates today. But the problem is that we're no longer selling an easy sale to a single decider. In that particular case, the shop owner was the only person who said yes, and nobody else was involved. Well, today, most purchases have multiple people that must say yes before you can proceed. You mentioned it earlier. CFOs have to approve the ad spend, even though that's a marketing function.
Yeah.
So the reality is that most of us sell to multiple deciders. Unless you're selling a consumer packaged good at Walmart, most times there are multiple people involved. In my life, Molly has to say yes to most purchases that I make, just the way that family dynamics works, right?
Yep. That's it. Well, yeah, I mean, you're saying that, and I think that's often an error with the sales guys is they're talking to the wrong person.
They do.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they believe that they can talk their way in and up. Well, here's the challenge is when we have multiple deciders involved, each one of them has a different yes set. Each one has a different vision of value. Each one is going to judge the purchase on a completely different set of criteria. And so in that particular case, a canned presentation falls apart because we, in that presentation, say things that these multiple deciders don't like, don't agree with, or isn't in the correct position. So John Patterson's methodology creates more problems than it solves in today's world. And you got to let it go unless you're selling to one person who's making the decision and nobody else is involved.
Yeah, I'm thinking of some work we did with a big bank, a Hong Kong bank, and they asked us to do their payment processing for an event they were doing in the UK. And I said, why would I do that? You guys are a bank. And he said, do you know how long it's going to take me to get IT to set this up?
Oh, yeah.
I said, I'm not setting up a PayPal account for you guys. You're a bank. I'm a marketing guy. I'll do the marketing, but you figure out the payment. And they're going, it'll take me 2 years.
Ouch.
He goes, this event's in 6 months.
Ouch.
So there's somebody who's in the decision process, IT, and they clearly aren't lining up with the sales and marketing vision.
That's right. And that's a problem. Well, the challenge with multiple deciders, Doug, is that when you're selling to somebody, they then have to go and persuade the other people involved to say yes. And frequently, they don't understand the mindset or the vision of the world that those other deciders are using. So what we're moving to is we have fundamentally a high consideration sales process for almost everything that we're doing when we're multiple people are involved.
But I might also say that it's not only the person that you're pitching or selling to that doesn't understand how the deciders view it. I would say as someone who's in sales that often I have that same problem because I just see what I want and I think is good for the client. And I don't understand how all the different department heads might view that and how that might impact their business and their decision.
And what that means is it's a complex sale.
Yeah.
You have to dig in and understand the motivation of each player. Well, the good news is that you can figure that out within about 80% just based on role and function in the organization, because every role and function has a specific temperament and specific goals that you can come pretty darn close most of the time. And I've teased that out. That's a book coming out in 2019 called Executive Temperament, How to Play and Play to Win in the C-Suite, where we've identified the personality types of each one of those executives involved. That's going to be a fantastic book. We can talk about that later on. In this environment, though, our job as a salesperson is not to prove that we're the best product. It's to prove that we're the lowest risk choice.
Okay. Different mindset for sure.
Radically different mindset because they don't care how good you are. If it's risky to them or risky to their chain of command up, the answer is going to be no. And the reality, there's a lot of crappy products out there that are sold continuously because they're the lowest risk.
Well, and not necessarily the lowest cost. I worked on a big IT project with government and they hired a couple of big brands. So it was like an IBM and Yahoo partnership. I said, well, why those guys? Well, no one gets fired for hiring IBM.
Right.
Okay. So it's a risk consideration because they were clearly the most expensive, but they were the lowest risk to the person making the decision was not going to get canned from their boss.
That's exactly right. In fact, my work with IBM is part of what allowed me to tease all this stuff out, to ask the question, why is it that nobody gets fired from buying IBM
Yep.
or AT&T?
Yep.
Why is that? Well, there's the reason why is because it's about risk reduction. It's not about quality of the product. Yeah, that has to be there, but it's that risk reduction.
Sure, absolutely.
So do we have enough time to talk about ways to reduce perceived risk?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a topic we need to cover.
All right, let's talk about that then. Well, there's fundamentally seven ways to help reduce perceived risk when we're talking to prospects. And the first one is really obvious. It's proof.
Sure.
And we do that through testimonials, case studies, a paid proof of concept. A couple of things you have to understand is that proof must be contextual to their business. So, for example, we can't use a transportation case study to sell to finance. They can't make the leap. They want to know that you have expertise in their area. And the proof must be relevant up the decision chain. Unfortunately, most case studies and proof statements and testimonials don't include all the other decision makers, the business decision maker, the technical decision maker, the financial decision maker, the customer impact decision maker, who all is involved, depending on the product and the service. They have to have all those elements be contextual and relevant up the business chain. And ideally, when it comes to proof, you have a preponderance of proof. You got lots and lots and lots of proof to help them with that. But unfortunately, proof isn't enough.
Yeah.
Got to have it, but it's not enough. You have to go to the second P of risk reduction, which is process. You have to show them how you're going to work together. Here's an important thing to understand. An executive will never agree to a project they don't know how to manage. So especially if what were things you're doing, Doug, if they don't know how it's going to work, and what I mean by that is what are the steps we're going to go through? What are the timelines? What are the milestones?
Sure.
How do I manage this? How do I make sure that this project stays on track and I don't squander my funds? So we have to show them how this is going to work. What that means is that project management, the timeline and milestones become part of the sales process when you're working with customers that have multiple decision makers. So they can look at it and go, oh, yep, that's doing well, or oh, we got to pay attention to that.
Yeah, and that helps reduce risk because they're looking at you as an entrepreneur going, oh, this guy's not just doing it on the back of a napkin. He's using a fill-in-the-blank project management tool. Right that he's invited me to the suite. I can see how it works. I can see the people, the team. We can see our deadlines, our goals, and milestones.
Right on. All of that is such a critical aspect of showing them how it works. Now, you don't have to show them how the watch works, but you have to show them that they fundamentally how the pieces play together.
Sure.
So that they can agree to this project. So process is the second P. Third P is progress. We want to illustrate that whenever they have a conversation with us, that they have an ever-expanding understanding about the solution. So there's a couple of things we can do to help them identify this progress, and that is to start every conversation with what would make this a valuable conversation to you? And poll everybody that you're talking to, either in the room or on the telephone, what's going to make this a great conversation? And then make sure that you can hit on those points. And if you can't, let them know in advance so they don't walk away frustrated.
Yeah.
And say, I'm not prepared to talk about that. So, and then point out that you've made progress from the conversations. And you can say, you asked for me to inform you about this. Did you get what you needed? And saying, what's the best idea you got from our conversation? And that throws cement on the fact that they know that you know what you're talking about. So this proves company viability. It proves the fact that you're a partner in helping them make progress.
Well, and I think it's a way that you're leading up as well. I mean, I know I worked on a large project and I'm very driven and goal-oriented. So my job and my goal was to get it done. And I did not lead up well and give progress updates. I had a deadline. I wanted to crush the deadline. And the team felt out of the loop.
Yeah. Yes, so that's a challenge.
So there wasn't the conversation that was, you know, it only would have taken a little bit of time to provide some regular updates. So they were felt comfortable. I thought, hey, man, we're just making good time. We're under budget. Things are just rocking. And without that communication and progress updates, you've got a client wondering, did they run off with my money? Are they really doing what they said?
That's a really good point, Doug. Progress updates are all about maintaining the feeling of the risk is in control.
Yeah. yeah, that's right.
All right. So the fourth P is position. How do you change how they look at your offering? Now, ideally, what we're going to do is position this so that what you're selling them contributes to multiple desired goals. And ideally, it's going to contribute to the goals of everybody who has to say yes. So it has to say yes to the customer, to the marketing department. It has to be a support the goals of the finance department, has to support the goals of the CEO, has to contribute to the goals of the sales department. So you're positioning this so as contributing to multiple goals. And one of the ways that you can position this to reduce risk is to compare it with an existing commitment. And an important thing to understand about position is that revolutionary scares people away. Radical scares people away, except at the executive, the CEO level. They're okay with radical because remember, they're creating a future that doesn't yet exist.
That's right. Yeah.
But for everybody else, revolutionary is risky. Evolutionary is what we want to do. So show them how it's going to be just a little better. It's going to remove some of the barriers. It's going to take them a little closer to where they want to be. So the positioning is really critical. And people that come and say, oh, new brand, new extraordinary. No, people are going, no, that's risky. We've all been burned by new ideas and new technology. So you have to position it correctly to reduce that perceived risk.
Well, it makes sense, like you said, that it identifies across a number of areas. I was thinking of a complex sale that we had, using your words, with a large sports radio station, and our pitch was going to be probably significantly more than the competitors. And I said, well, the issue wasn't just building them a website. It was providing a tool that the DJs could use because they're not tech guys. It was opening up new marketing channels and new advertising. So bringing them new revenue that they currently didn't have. So it wasn't simply about, delivering on one aspect. Hey, we need a website. It's like, no, you don't. What you need is new revenue. You need a tool that's easy to use for your DJs. That's easy for your listeners to log into. So it became more than just what they asked for.
Right on. Yep. That's the concept of positioning. Great example, Doug. Yeah. All right. The fifth P of how to reduce perceived risk is prestige. Keep in mind that almost every decision that somebody makes in a corporate environment is going to be weighed against the impact of their career. The way that we make serious bank in the corporate world is not through raises, and that's pretty small, but through promotions. You have to be elevated in the organization. And the only way you get promoted is that if you illustrate consistent good judgment. And so if you make a purchase and it doesn't work out, that's going to count against your good judgment. An executive will never promote somebody to their inner circle that might embarrass them because that illustrates bad judgment up the food chain. So the reality is that every purchase decision has a career impact, and we got to call out the elephant in the room.
Yep.
It's just people got to get this in their brain. Yeah. People are not buying your product. They're buying a path to a promotion. Ooh.
Yeah,
that should just rattle your brain for a moment.
Yeah, I'm just smiling because I've been in those situations, and you're right. People are afraid to make the wrong decision. Back to the IBM, for example. Great product, great service, maybe not the right solution for a new startup.
No.
But, the risk is less.
Well, theoretically, if you have a scorekeeper.
Yep.
All right. Now, keep in mind, entrepreneurs only have one scorekeeper. That would be their spouse or the bank or their investor.
Right. Yeah.
But in a corporate environment, hiring IBM is going to protect somebody against a bad decision because they're relying on the consulting power of IBM. But for an entrepreneurial organization, you're going to really pay for that, but you don't have to cover yourself because you don't have that scorekeeper. So prestige is the P. What's the value to their career? How can it increase their personal power? How does it add value to their position? How can it create desirable uniqueness for them? What's the PR value? All of those things are part of the prestige. So if you work with somebody and say, I wouldn't do this with an entrepreneur, but I would do it with anyplace else. What is your career path looking like? All right. So what can we do to work together to help you hit that career goal? Is this part of the consideration that your boss and their team are going to consider whether you are promotable or not through powerful performance? And if you call that out, it changes the dynamic radically. Now, this is a pretty disruptive idea.
Well, I was just going to say that's some pretty new thinking, at least for where I sit, to have that conversation. But that the prospect sitting across the desk from you is thinking that.
Right. And if you can state what the prospect is thinking and nobody else has talked about it, you've created a competitive advantage that is unmatched.
Sure.
Your competitors will never know what hit them.
Yeah. Wow. That's pretty cool.
Then all right, excellent. I love it. So the 6P of how to reduce perceived risk is price. Now, I don't mean having the lowest price, because as we've been talking about, price is usually only important if everything else is equal. When everything else is identical, price becomes the differentiator. And your job is to make sure that nothing is equal.
Right.
Instead, what I'm talking about is show them how to radically lower the cost of how they're accomplishing their objective. And that reduces perceived risk. Because if they can do what they're doing right now for 15 or 20% less, well, then it's risky to continue to do it the way they're doing it.
Sure, that's bad. That's bad judgment. Like, why are you spending that much money when you don't have to?
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So fundamentally, the way that we radically lower cost is by simplification, elimination, and automation. And you talked about that with your DJ experience a little earlier in this conversation about showing them how to do something they couldn't do before as a tool. That's simplify, automate type of situation. So simplify, eliminate, and automate spell C. It's the easy way to remember them. So we got to do a C change. And that's a fundamental methodology of reducing perceived risk, if you can help them do that. Another thing we can do is show them how to pay for it, whether it's a reduced cost or show them where to find the funds, and show them how to increase their cash flows. Since for the financial person, improving cash flows is fundamental to their key performance indicators. That's one of the things that you can do in the price strategy. Fundamentally, draw them a line to the money. So price is one of your 7 P's. Ready for the last one?
Yeah. And before you move to the last one, I mean, the other thing might be just inefficiency.
Indeed. So absolutely true.
Your pricing for your new technology or solution might be more than they were anticipating spending. But like you said, you can draw a line to profitability by saying this is costing you. Your productivity would increase by 30%.
That's exactly right.
So it's a lost opportunity. So yeah, ready for the last
Indeed.
One.
Indeed. No, right on. No, I think that's really important is show them the cost. One of the strategies to accelerate deals is show them the price of waiting. Show them the cost of waiting.
Sure. Yeah.
Show them the cost of not acting. And so that's part of that concept. I love it. All right. So the 7th P of how to reduce perceived risk is parachute. Parachute is the guarantee. It's the thing that will allow them to survive and their career to thrive if something goes way wrong. And the way we handle that parachute is with a guarantee, anything that you can control. Now, you can uncover where they feel this risk by asking the question, what do you need to be guaranteed to agree to this? That doesn't mean you have to guarantee it, but that question will flush out their remaining fears.
Right.
And then we can either address it or we can walk away from the deal because we can't serve everybody, don't want to serve everybody. So other ways of creating a parachute is by offering insurance. What can you insure? And your parachute offer should scare you and relieve your customer. For an example, here's a parachute that might be a little frightening. Let's say you're selling a computer product and you tell your customer, look, I know this is a high consideration deal. You've got a lot of people looking over your shoulder. If it goes wrong, it's not good for your career. So I'm going to make sure that we have a protection for you. We've got a parachute for you in case something crashes and burns. What we're going to do is if we do not fulfill the agreement that we make, we're going to rip out our equipment. We're going to bring in a third-party consultant that's going to figure out how to solve the problem for you. And we're going to pay the difference between what you paid us and what it costs for you to install the right solution. Does that make you feel a little more comfortable? Now, to most people selling, that scare the crap out of them.
Sure. Yep. I totally get that.
Yeah. But the reality is that feeling of fear of what if some things go wrong is the feeling your customer has.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking back of a case study I read about SAP, and when they were failing, their numbers were declining in terms of their revenue. So their revenue, what was keeping them afloat were people renewing their software and renewing their licenses, but their new installations were declining. And, you know,
yes,
good, lucky enough, the company figured it out and they got it turned around. But people couldn't leave because they were so committed to that software. And if someone had come along and said, we'll take it out, like you said, to your point, we'll install our stuff. And if it doesn't work better than what you're currently using for less money, go back to what you're using. They probably wouldn't exist today.
Yeah, right. And we'll pay for that reinstallment.
Yeah.
And the reality is if you stand behind your products like this, and you do your work up front, you're not going to fail. You know, Doug, I have a 100% money back guarantee as a speaker. You're going to love my speech or you don't pay, including expenses.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've only had to do it twice. And what has happened along the way is, number one, that guarantee, make sure I only take engagements that I know I can knock out of the park.
Yeah, for sure.
Because the ones I had to return the money when, I had no business doing those speeches. Now, I've been doing this for 28 years, so.
Yeah, wow.
And number two is that it keeps me dropping the F-bomb on the platform. So. All right. So to wrap this up, the reducing perceived risk, the seven P's are proof, process, progress, position, prestige, price, and parachute. And when you use those everywhere you can, you know, you can do that in ad copy, you can do it in marketing, you can do it in your sales presentations, you can do it in your conversations. But the more of those P's you can use in your conversation, the lower the perceived risk and the faster you can close deals.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm thinking of your last point, and I remember when I was working for someone else in sales, and it was a commodity type business, and they normally had customers sign long-term contracts. And our sales manager said, do whatever you can to get the business. And that means even giving them credit for their suppliers' products that are currently on the floor.
Sure.
So we'd go in, we'd sign new contracts, we would phone our guys, they would come remove all the competitors' products, deliver them back to the competitor, which they hated. And then we would give them a credit for what we just took off their floor so they wouldn't have to pay twice to make the switch.
Love it. Love that idea. In fact, that's a really great idea. And that is the offer to help your customer break up with their competitor.
Yeah. I mean, we said, hey, we'll do it, you know, because they don't want to have that conversation.
No, they don't. Nope. Breaking up with your competitor is a tough thing to do. In fact, if people say, you know, we like the people we have right now, well, we don't have time to do this right now, unfortunately, Doug, but I do have an entire script on how to identify the value or the relationship with the competition. I've got so much stuff, friend.
Well, I mean, I'll, time permitting, sometime in the next year, we'll have to do this again.
Yeah, we can surely we'll do it again. But there's a lot of stuff we've talked about today, and thank you for letting me share some of the thoughts that I have about how entrepreneurs can make that pivot to an executive and the fundamentals of how can you increase and speed up your deal flow.
Yeah, that's really cool. Like you said, there's a ton of information here. I'm looking forward to going through the show notes and redigesting the points that you shared as well.
Well, a delight to be on your show. Thank you. And a delight for your listeners. So if you want to get a hold of me, it's actually really simple. MarksOnLinkedIn.com. Marks, M-A-R-K-S, on LinkedIn.com. That'll take you directly to my profile. Ask to friend me, and we can connect there very easily. The second thing you can do is check out my Executive Strategy Skills Summit, executivestrategysummit.com. Exactly as it sounds, executivestrategysummit.com. And you can also easily find me on Google if you Google Mark S. A. Smith. I have two middle initials. If you do Mark Smith, you'll never find me. But Mark S. A. Smith, and you'll see all of the stuff I have out there. I publish a video every day on an executive strategy skill. I do articles every week. Podcasts. My podcast is The Selling Disruption Show, sellingdisruptionshow.com. You can find it everywhere on all the platforms. And hey, I'm always open to a conversation, always. I'll talk to anybody for 20 minutes. If you want a conversation with me, just introduce yourself. I'd be delighted to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll make sure we get this transcribed and we'll make sure we have all the proper links in the show notes. So two questions and I'll let you go. First question is a Tim Ferriss question I ripped off from his last book. And what's some of the bad advice that you hear in this space?
I think the bad advice is talk about your features and your advantages and your benefits of your product and you're going to persuade your customers to buy. That does not work anymore. You have to understand your customer's motivation. When you understand their objectives and their priorities and their criteria, then we can map their motivation to the product versus attempting to map the product to their motivation.
Yeah, this is a radically different, I think, at least for me anyhow, it's a radically different approach of thinking that's well beyond your product when you're starting to think about people's careers, career path,
right on.
And what it means to them and their business beyond just the transaction of fixing the X problem.
Well, we're talking about the hidden factors that impact every sales decision that people have just not been aware of.
Yeah, obviously not lots here. If you're running a pizza company, it's a pretty simple decision. There's one person that's going to make the decision. It's going to be my wife. So,
Well, there's some truth to that. Yet most of the people that are entrepreneurs aren't probably listening to your podcast. They're just running their business.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's true. I mean, you know, they don't take time for personal development. Or I don't know. Obviously, some people do. For me, it's a huge investment. It's the only way I can stay current.
Indeed. Well, and when you sell a complex product like you do,
yep,
then this is the type of thing we have to talk about. When you're selling something simple, consumer packaged good, anything at a fast food restaurant, All of that is fast-moving consumer goods. We use a radically different approach to sell that. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about here is how do you sell high-consideration products and services that yep. involve multiple decision-makers?
Yep, absolutely.
That's my superpower.
Well, there you go. I asked you what your superpower was at the beginning. And so listeners, I mean, that's my preferred way to sell. I mean, I always find that the food line is shorter when you're selling a six-figure solution than when you're selling, you know, a four-figure solution.
Right on.
So if you're going to sell, you might as well sell and go for the big win.
Right on.
So thanks so much, Mark. Really super appreciate you coming on and sharing with the listeners today. Like I said, we'll get the show notes transcribed. Is there anything you want to close with before we sign off for today?
I do. Remember, my friends, that you, as the executive, as the leader of your organization, are the only one that sets the direction. Remember, you're creating a future that does not yet exist using methods that have not yet been invented, where best practices have yet to be established. And what that means, my friend, is enjoy the adventure.
Wow. I don't think I could have said that any better. So thanks, listeners, for tuning in. Don't be shy to leave a comment in the show notes when they're published. Make sure you're subscribed to us on iTunes. Let us know if there's a topic you'd like us to cover. So thanks so much for listening today, and we look forward to serving you on our next episode.
That's all for this episode of Real Marketing Real Fast. Now it's time to take your marketing to the next level by visiting DougMorneau.com and downloading our advanced marketing white papers, as well as exclusive resources based on today's episode. That's DougMorneau.com. Until next time, we look forward to serving you right here on Real Marketing Real Fast.